Welcome back to the Multicultural Middle Ages. This is John from the podcast team. In today's episode, we'll dive into the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Join us as we explore why this area and its conflict are essential topics for scholars of the Middle Ages. Joining me today is Kristina Marantse, the Mashtats Professor of Armenian Studies at Harvard University. Professor Marantse is an accomplished scholar, boasting 4 academic monographs and over 100 articles and essays on medieval Armenian art and architecture. Directly relevant to our conversation, Professor Marantse has worked on issues of cultural heritage for over a decade, focusing on at-risk Armenian sites and monuments. Welcome, Kristina.
Thank you.
Let's jump right in. Living in the United States, it is a sad truth that the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh, a mountainous region in modern-day Azerbaijan that has been home to Armenians for centuries, has received very little coverage in news outlets. The ethnic cleansing of Armenians in the territory, as well as the involvement of foreign powers, should concern and upset us all. Could you talk to us about the Nagorno-Karabakh region and the conflict which hit a major turning point recently?
Yeah, I know. It's not a place that is well known to many Americans or to people outside of those actors who are really in the midst of the conflict. And this is a great problem because, as you know, if you don't know, then you can't care. And this is a really good example of that. Nagorno-Karabakh, or Mountainous Karabakh, as it would be translated from the Russian, is a region in the South Caucasus. First of all, let's just say it's a mountainous region. It's a beautiful region, John. It's spectacular with mountains and rivers and just a bounty of flora and fauna, not to mention the cultural heritage, which we'll talk about in a minute. It's a region that has been contested between Armenia and Azerbaijan for over a century now. Before January 1st of this year, there was an Armenian exclave, that is a kind of island of Armenians living in the region that were connected to the Republic of Armenia by a single corridor called the Lachin Corridor. So you have to imagine a kind of, as Wikipedia will tell you, a kind of kidney-shaped region to the east of the Republic of Armenia, connected by a kind of umbilical cord called the Lachin Corridor, and otherwise surrounded by the Republic of Azerbaijan. And it is this region which had been, as you mentioned, ethnically Armenian for centuries, which has been at the heart of conflict now for many reasons, but many, many decades, really, since the Soviet era. And the conflict heated up after the fall of the Soviet Union, erupting into the first Nagorno-Karabakh War, and then as of 2020, the more famous war, at least for those of us who have more, you know, were kind of been sentient more recently, is that of the Second Karabakh War of 2020. And that's when we really get into some of the questions of cultural heritage that we'll be addressing later on. This second war led to a ceasefire in 2020. In December, and that led to the seizure of several regions of Nagorno-Karabakh to Azerbaijan. There were renewed offensives on the part of Azerbaijan in 2023, leading to a blockade of the region, meaning the severe suffering of Armenians who couldn't get medical supplies through that umbilical cord of the Lachin Corridor, couldn't get food, and ultimately led to the massive cleansing of Armenians from that whole region. And now they're really ethnically, we don't know the numbers, but there are surely very, very few, if any, Armenians still living in the region for the first time in history. So what the Armenians refer to as the Republic of Artsakh is now no longer. It's simply part of Azerbaijan. And this happened on January 1st of this year. So a lot of heartache, a lot of bloodshed, a lot of tears, a lot of suffering, a lot of human lives lost, and really terrible feeling across these two nations, across these two peoples. And those wounds are wide open.
Before moving forward, it's important to clarify that in terms of military strength and resources, This was a very disparate confrontation. This was not a struggle between equal powers.
This is one of the problems with the kind of tendency, particularly for American Anglophone media, to make equivalent these places that we don't know. I feel so sorry for those people, whether it's, you know, the Armenia, Azerbaijan, whether it's Eritrea and Ethiopia. Most Americans know so little about these places, and unfortunately, they start with the same letter. It's unfortunate that we don't know more, that we can't understand. These are not symmetrical conflicts. And so in the case of Azerbaijan and Armenia, we're dealing on the one hand with an autocratic state, oil-rich state, in the case of Azerbaijan, who can pay for good relations, whether it's with UNESCO or with whatever superpower they want. And Armenia isn't in that position. It is a struggling democracy and simply doesn't have those resources. So these are not at all equivalent actors or agents. And that gets really lost when you start doing these very superficial, oh, why can't these people far away just get along? And one of the phrases I hate more than any is age-old ethnic conflict, which is a kind of racist way of saying, oh, you silly people, why can't you just get along? So I'm quite sensitive to the ways in which in the popular media in this country, we kind of set aside and we really kind of devalue the people who are struggling in these far-off regions and the way we do that with language.
What you just said highlights the importance of our conversation. We want to help foster awareness for this situation since, as you well said, if you don't know, you can't care. Maybe we can turn now to the cultural aspect since it's part of the work you do. You have written about the urgent need to protect the cultural heritage of the Nagorno-Karabakh region. We are, of course, especially passionate about the medieval period, but could you talk to us a little about some of the sites and the objects that need to be protected?
Absolutely. So there are many, many sites. Depending how you count them, there can be thousands, there can be hundreds, from cemeteries to churches and monasteries to bridges to getting into early modern mansions, going back to the ancient. There's a Hellenistic city. There are early Christian basilicas and tombs that are extraordinary. And we are not in a position of being able to, not only can we not study them anymore, but they really have only been thinly studied by experts. I think one of the things we realized too late with the most recent conflicts is that we don't know these places as well as we should. There was something that happened in 2020, which I call a kind of emergency art history, where we just all started to learn as much as we could about these places that we knew were at risk. Amazing places. So 13th century monasteries that are not only exquisite from an architectural point of view, but are literally archives of hundreds of Armenian inscriptions detailing donations and people and families and pieties, wall paintings, relief sculpture. Just an extraordinary tradition that is connected to Armenia, that's connected to Byzantium, that's connected to the Persian world. And that world is not only rich, but it has the potential to tell a really interesting story, a connected story about people, about relics, about cities. It's a shame that it is now basically off limits. So it's tremendously rich. I mentioned cemeteries, but we're talking about kochkars. So these are Armenian carved cross stones, of which there are hundreds in Nagorno-Karabakh. These are not just carved stones, but they often have iconography, really unusual, like a breastfeeding virgin, possibly. But we don't know if it's a virgin or if it's a mother. So these are really interesting questions. If we could get access to the site, we could think more about that. But also these kochkars are inscribed. So they tell us individuals who otherwise are unattested. So there's a question here, too, about memory, about memories that are at risk. memories of, you know, just generations and generations of Armenians. Yeah, it's a culture that is complex. And that complexity we lose. When you're fighting for just the health of a monument, things can get reductive and we can forget how complex and open-ended these sites are and how much more work there is to be done.
I just love talking to art historians. You are all so passionate about your materials and it always shows.
Yeah, we love our stuff. We do.
What's your favorite monument or object in the area?
Oh, that's a tough one. I have a few. I mean, the monastery that I sort of feature when I write sort of general things is Ganzasar, which is this 13th century monastery, which uses ideas that are really kind of refining Armenian architecture. So it has a pointed kind of what they call an umbrella dome, where it's kind of got these pleats. It has amazing relief sculpture with donors and holding church models. There's a portal that is polychrome, maroon, and silvery gray in this geometric pattern of interlocking circles. The sculpture perforates into the wall, but there are also projections. When I talk about complexity, it's not just sort of historical complexity, it's visual complexity. So that's probably just one of my all-time favorites, Ganzasar. And that, again, that's in a region that was ceded to Azerbaijan this year, so as of January 1st. And that, I think there's a lot of worry about that one. I love the breastfeeding woman, mother, virgin, Kachkar. That's also amazing. There's a beautiful and unusual early Christian basilica called Sitsernavunk, which relates to the swallows. It translates as kind of monastery of the swallows bird. And it's just gorgeous. It's one of the very few intact early Christian basilicas that we have, period. So the fact that it is in Nagorno-Karabakh is amazing. And then the last thing I will just mention is a really interesting, again, early Christian phenomenon in the region where you have eastern entrances to a tomb. There's a tomb with an eastern entrance and another potential tomb also with an eastern entrance. And the scholar who's worked on these, who's an archaeologist, has suggested really interestingly, I think, that they're connected to the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem with this idea that it's oriented in the other way. And so that is just one really tantalizing example of connections with other places, in this case, with the heart of Christendom. Okay, one more example, because I'm just on a roll here. So in Armenia and in Georgia, we have these early Christian obelisks, like carved obelisks, super interesting with iconography. Interestingly, in Nagorno-Karabakh, you see these revived in the early modern period. So like 16th century, we have these obelisks that are, you know, they're Christian and they're carved with scenes. But why, you know, why this return to an early Christian mode? It's so fascinating to me. So I know that I'm going to think of a million more things after this that I forgot to talk about, but I just want to give your listeners a sense of the surprises that you can find in the region. This is one of the most understudied medieval cultures that I know. I mean, this and really there's just something for everyone from antiquity to early modernity. There's so much.
And now the sites and objects in this region are off limits, correct? Is this an official Azerbaijani policy?
I think that if you were to try to go, you might get a whole range of explanations of why you couldn't go. Back when there was a kind of smaller version after several regions were seized by Azerbaijan, my friends tried to go to the remaining Armenian exclave and were denied. And there were always various reasons given. It's a bureaucratic thing. And it's not been possible for organizations like UNESCO to go and to do work monitoring in any real way, in any kind of fact-finding way. The one really good thing that came out of the horrors was an organization that was developed really in response to the lack of possibility of monitoring called Caucasus Heritage Watch. And this is a group of scholars from Cornell and Purdue universities who began at that time to start a satellite monitoring. I remember being in on some of the early initiatives where they were like, okay, we need to get the coordinates for all these sites and we need to triage this. Like, what are the most important sites? And they had this Excel spreadsheet of coordinates. And then they were able to get the satellite, the thing that goes up in the sky, right? And so that's been amazing. Because where you cannot be on the ground and actually sort of monitor the status, you can watch from the sky. Nobody's going to stop that, except if the weather. And you can see, for example, not just destruction, but you can see, is there a dump truck getting close to this building? And so Caucasus Heritage Watch will issue an alert because they know what it looks like. We've seen Azerbaijan destroy whole landscapes before. That's kind of their modus operandi for destruction. We know it from another region called Nakhchivan, where they destroyed a whole cemetery and lots of churches using ground moving equipment. So we know what it looks like. We know what the patterns are. So when Caucasus Heritage Watch issues an alert, look, there's a big dump truck moving near the church, everyone knows it. They post it online. The other thing that they say, and I think this is important, is that it can be a deterrent. When you know you're being watched, it can cause a kind of accountability. In any case, what they do is they're compiling data, they issue reports, they talk about erasure and who's doing it and why. So I would really encourage your listeners, check it out. If you just Google Caucasus Heritage Watch, it will come up. And it's a really amazing website with a dashboard and series of befores and afters. So I would highly, highly recommend that website.
Just wow. The reality that these erasures are taking place is really upsetting, but I think it also speaks to the importance of our work as scholars of the past. We care about these sites and these objects. The Caucasus Heritage Watch is an amazing development that can only happen when we care about our objects of study as much as we do. Before we move from these erasures, let me ask why. What does a state stand to gain from erasing or rewriting the archaeological, the cultural, or even the historical record? For me, it seems to be a strategy to construct, perhaps the correct word is control, a national narrative.
I mean, it's sort of classic invention of history. And it is summed up by, I was mentioning the erasure of the cemetery of Khachkars in Nakhchivan. And when asked about this, the spokesman for the Azerbaijani government, this was years ago, said, there can't have been a cemetery there because there were never any Armenians there, which is not just the erasure of culture, it's the erasure of memory. These people never existed. So that's a kind of state ideology and is really the most perverse part of this.
This is honestly terrifying. It is also a textbook example of the past being rewritten and weaponized to advance the agenda of an oppressive state. Furthermore, it shows that our research, which is about excavating the past in many ways, is never apolitical. On this vein, I'm curious about the kind of narrative that we can piece together by considering the sites and objects of the region. When looked at historically, for instance, this region boasts a rich diversity and multiculturality, correct?
Right. You know, this is a real problem. I think when you have a country, a culture, a community like Armenia that is seeing this kind of devastation of their cultural heritage, right, and people, human lives, the natural response is to double down on the Armenianness of everything. And I understand that. I feel that myself. What's really interesting for me, though, and what I've always found interesting about the Middle Ages is the connections across cultures. And Armenia is such a good example of connections, whether it's to the Byzantine world, the Islamic world, East Asia. We have it all, right? And what you see with Nagorno-Karabakh is kind of these narratives, sometimes that can be kind of exclusionary. So it's Armenian. Or on the Azerbaijani side, there's a narrative which is where I'm not at all making these equivocal, but they're producing this narrative, the government, that this is all Caucasian Albanian, which is itself a hodgepodge of a complex series of concepts, some of which there is truth to, but a lot of which is simply weaponizing the past in order to erase Armenian culture. That could be a whole other session. And the problem, you know, with it is that this culture of Caucasian Albania, which did exist, has left very little in the way of traces. So literally like two inscriptions. And so what we know of these people is very limited, and they seem to disappear after the Abbasid period. So 9th century, it seems to be that their identity kind of gets absorbed into a wider Armenity. Having said that, we see in the narratives what people are telling themselves about the region division. So some people will say, well, Armenian culture stops at this bank of the Kura River, which was a river in the region, and the Albanian culture starts on the other side. That's one way people will tell the story. But I understand right now, maybe that's the best we can do. And I don't want to be one of those people that tries to force a multiculturalism onto this region. This is not the time for that. I think maybe in 25 years, we're going to be asking questions about you can cross a river, you can get to the other side, and you can think about a riverine culture. What does it mean to share a river? But I don't know if this is the time. I think there's too much happening right now in the moment. This is really wartime art history. And so I think that's going to take time. It's going to take generations. It's going to take healing to start to be able to be curious about things. We're not there yet.
I understand. So in this time of crisis and heartache, what is, in your opinion, our role or even our responsibility as scholars of the Middle Ages? And on a related note, a reason for this recovery work, this emergency art history, is the fact that this region has not really been the object of extensive scholarly attention. So as we think about our responsibility to this region and its cultural heritage, perhaps we can also consider, how have we failed?
Yeah, those are great questions. You know, it was really shocking to me, having studied and taught and researched Armenian art for so long, the extent to which there were so many unknowns. There are just a few sources that we can reliably use for, let's say, the monuments. There's one scholar who's really an authority on the manuscripts of the region. So we're really talking about just a very few. And I think there are various reasons for that. It's an area, of course, as I mentioned, that has been in conflict. It's not in the heart of the Republic of Armenia, where you can just go make an easy day trip. And it's not easy going. I mean, I was there in the year 2000, and I remember how long it took to get, the roads are terrible, just getting to, you know, the capital of Stepanakert at that time. That took a whole day. But I also think that there's always this tendency to study centers as opposed to peripheries. And maybe Nagorno-Karabakh has been on the periphery of the study of Armenian art. And not to say all the monuments. As I mentioned, Ganzasar, that's a kind of gem that everyone knows and studies. But there's so many others. So I think it's been on the margins of the margins, you could say. And that's something, of course, that we critique as art historians, right? And as cultural historians, we critique this concept of periphery, the very idea of it. So I think this is a moment for us to take that seriously and try to address this culture that has so much to teach us. So I think in terms of our responsibility, you know, I'm deeply aware of how much I don't know about the world and about all the conflicts that are happening, all the heartache that is happening that I'm blind to, that I'm not paying attention to. We all beat ourselves up about that. And it's hard, I know, to keep track of places that you've never heard of. And I think, you know, just what you're doing is really a great step forward. I think what you're doing in terms of allowing me to come and have this platform and talk about this really open horizon of culture, this place of recent heartache that has so much to offer, is a great step. And although the circumstances are really sad, the circumstances are just deeply troubling, say something terrible about us as humans, you're giving me the opportunity to speak about it is great. And I hope that your listeners too will take something from it. I truly believe that we can learn and teach. That's what we do as scholars, right? So that's what we must do. And sometimes that means, you know, the hard truths, but I'm just delighted to, you know, to be able to share it. It's our burden, right? It's our responsibility to do that as best we can.
That's all the time we have for today, but I want to thank you, Christina, for joining us and for this really, really, really engaging conversation in which you've reminded us of our responsibility as scholars and the importance of doing recovery work in the many forms that this recovery work can take. It was truly a pleasure to spend this time with you and to learn from you. Thank you.
Thank you. I just hope we all get a chance to go and visit the amazing landscape of Nagorno-Karabakh, and without fear, you know, that would be great.
This has been an episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 3 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Rita O'Mara, and Logan Quigley, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with new episodes.